Okay, Judges chapter 9 has a very dramatic story. Plenty of action, plenty of times in which it was, if it was a movie, you'd have to close your eyes. It's not for the faint-hearted, but there is a lot to learn here about human nature, about false hopes, the self-destructiveness of evil, and finally the recurring message of the book about the only one who truly is the hope of the world. We dive into the story, right? It's about the son of Gideon called Abimelech. Now, Gideon is referred to in verse 1 by his nickname Jerubbaal, which is a reminder of back in chapter 6 how he tore down the altar of Baal. And Abimelech is sadly not going to be like that. He is not going to stand against idolatry the way Gideon did at that point in his life. I used to hate people asking, well, are you going to follow in your father's footsteps? For a long time, I was determined to do anything but. And apparently Abimelech had that same kind of attitude. While Gideon, for all of his faults, was one of the judges of Israel, raised up to deliver Israel, Abimelech was like the opposite. He was like an anti-judge. Instead of saving Israel from her enemies, Abimelech actually became her oppressor. So, no, he didn't follow in his father's footsteps. He went to his hometown of Shechem, verse 1, which, by the way, for any Israelite, was no ordinary place. Shechem was the place where God appeared to Abraham way back, telling him that the land was going to be given to him. Shechem was the very first place then that an altar was built in worship of the Lord in the promised land. Shechem was the first place where Abraham's descendants gathered to worship the Lord after they crossed over into the land under Joshua. So basically, if you're an Israelite, Shechem was special. Now try to imagine if Croke Park, for example, was somehow taken over and adopted as the new home of English cricket. That kind of unthinkable sacrilege is kind of like what happens in Shechem. Here in chapter 9. Instead of a place where God is worshipped and his promises celebrated, Shechem becomes a place where God is mocked and his people basically self-destruct in their own evil. Abimelech arrives and he cuts right to the chase. Listen up, everyone. You know that Gideon has 70 other sons. Well, I don't want to scare you, but you don't want 70 of them trying to rule over you, do you? I mean, how much less chaotic it would be if just one son ruled over you, like like maybe me. Oh, and by the way, he says, my mom is a Shechem girl. I am related to you by blood. And immediately, as we're reading this, immediately we know that this is very, very different from what we've seen in Judges so far. Because normally we read in Judges that so-and-so was raised up by God to lead and save Israel from her enemies. But nothing like that is said of Abimelech. Evidently, the only calling that Abimelech has is from his own ego. He wants to rule. He wants power. And maybe as the illegitimate son of one of Gideon's concubines, he perhaps grew up more insecure than most. But he was desperate to be somebody important. Desperate to be somebody more important, in fact, and more powerful than all of his 70 brothers. He doesn't want to rule with them. He wants to rule instead of them. And I think here we get a really great insight into human nature. I know that Abimelech is a really extreme example of this, but it's we learn from him about human nature. C.S. Lewis wrote that we tend to think of people being proud or rich or clever or good-looking, but they're not proud of those things. C.S. Lewis said, the truth is that they're proud of being richer or cleverer or better-looking than others. And if everyone else became equally rich or clever or good-looking, then there'd be nothing to be proud about anymore. And that's what we see here in the extreme, the dark side of human nature, that we want others to be less than we are. We'd never be so crude as to say that. But we all know that in any sport, a draw is really unsatisfying. Nobody wants to draw. When you're small, you might be excited to get a star from the teacher in your class. But if the teacher then says, hey, you're all winners, you all get a star, suddenly you're not better than anyone, and your shine is somewhat, the shine of your achievement is somewhat gone. That's how we tend to feel. If you buy yourself the best outfit and make yourself look amazing, it's fantastic until you walk into a room and discover that two other people are wearing the same thing and looking far better than you. This is going to sound really shallow, but I remember talking to a friend at university about who I was going to take to the whole ball, and he said to me, you know, wouldn't it be class to walk in with a girl on your arm who would instantly make you the envy of every guy in the room? And, you know, you can laugh at that or shake your head in despair, but if you can't relate to that kind of thinking, then you're probably in denial. It's a basic trait of our human selfishness that we want to stand out. We have this craving to outshine and not to be outshone, to be better than others, more important, more popular, more intelligent, more attractive, or in Abimelech's case, more powerful. In verse 4, he hires a bunch of yobs with some good pagan money, and then he goes to a place called Ophrah with his new gang, and he solemnly butchers Gideon's 70 sons on a single stone in verse 5. Now that is an extreme way to go, but such is his wicked desire to be the only one who can ever rule. Clearly it's hideous in the extreme, but it is actually happening today in places like North Korea, where the megalomaniac dictator Kim Jong-un executed his own uncle at the end of last year and has since ordered, according to some reports, the total elimination of his uncle's biological relatives. And we, of course, want to believe that we do not share that same human nature as people who descend into such depraved evil. We're not like that. Well, we may not, thankfully, have descended into such brutal depravity. But that is actually the direction in which our human nature would take us if it were not restrained by many, many good things. According to the Bible, the seeds of every sin, even the worst kind of evil, is rooted within us. Now, thankfully, not every seed manages to grow and blossom in our lives, thankfully. But the fact is that all the perverse things in the world, and this is not a happy message in the Bible, but all the perverse things in the world, Jesus said in Mark 7, come out of the human heart. We want to blame the environment in which we grow up. We want to blame the peer group and all the bad influences that are out there in the world. But the truth is that we human beings are flawed from the inside out. That's why human history is the way it is. And of course, we're not as bad as we could be, and God has molded us for good in so many ways. But in light of our basic human desire to trump others, we still have to look at the wickedness of people like Abimelech and say, there but for the grace of God go I. There is no sin that you could not commit yourself given different circumstances. Even the fact that we support a democratic system of government is not because we're all so fair-minded. It's because people are basically bad, and no one person should be trusted with too much power. That's why democracy is really important. Because we all know what happens when somebody gets too much power. So there's the first part of the story in verses 1 to 5. A violent and extreme example of the basic human trait we all grew up with, wanting to be above others for the sake of our own glory. And then, if that wasn't bad enough, we see the folly of a false hope. What do the people of Shechem say in verse 6? Do they say, hang on, wait a minute, everyone, this Abimelech dude is clearly a complete psycho. We better not make him king after all. Nope. All the leaders of Shechem get together and they make Abimelech their king. Verse 6. You talk about false hope. I was reading only this week somewhere about Hitler's rise to power and how people were so taken in by his rhetoric. He was a very impressive leader and, of course, a very impressive orator. In the case of Abimelech, his appeal was quite simply that he was one of them. Verse 3, they said, he's our brother. Which is basic tribalism, isn't it? And yet the irony is, of course, that they had only just witnessed what Abimelech did to 70 of his brothers, albeit on his father's side. You would think that someone might have said, fellas, before you buy into the brother argument, you might want to think about how he actually treats his brothers. But no, apparently no one worried about that. He must be okay. His mother's relatives all speak well of him. It's amazing how easily we buy into a false hope. And of course, there's a lesson here about the kind of leaders that we ought to choose. But let me broaden the application. Think about the number of false hopes there are in the world. I once preached a series on the book of Ecclesiastes, another book in the Bible, and it unpacks a whole load of false hopes, which I think we can all relate to. You might give your life to work, but what does man gain for all his toil under the sun? Answer, a few more wrinkles and an aching body so that one day you'll no longer be able to enjoy the work of your hands. Your work will never give you the security and the permanence that you long for, says the teacher in Ecclesiastes. Or you might give yourself to learning and to education, but by the time you become an expert, by the time you really know something, you retire and die. Bleak, but that's how it is. You might pursue wealth and riches, but of course, no matter how much you make, it'll never be enough. John D. Rockefeller, at one time the richest man in the world, was once asked how much money it would take for a person to be really satisfied. Just a little bit more, he said. And you can live to make a real difference in the world through politics or science or through education, and indeed we should. But we need to remember that neither politics, nor science, nor education is going to change human hearts from self-serving to self-giving. I read this quotation from a man called George Bernanos. He said, in order to be prepared to hope in what does not deceive, we must first lose hope in everything that deceives. I'm going to say that again. In order to be prepared to hope in what does not deceive, we must first lose hope in everything that deceives. And unfortunately, in the story of Abimelech, I'm afraid the people discover this much too late. The rest of the chapter, following where Peter stopped reading in verse 21, the rest of the chapter is really a display of the self-destructiveness of evil, of how tragic it is to bank on a false hope. The lesson comes from this guy called Jotham, who pops up in verse 7, the one single brother who managed to escape the massacre in verse 5. He tells a parable about trees. It's quite a weird parable, but it's simple enough. He tells this parable to show how Abimelech and the people of Shechem are about to be given over by God to their own self-destruction. Verses 8 to 15, the trees want a king. But the nice olive tree says no, and the good fig tree says no, and the lovely vine says no. So finally, the stupid trees go to the useless thorn bush in verse 14 and say, you be our king. Everybody knew that a thorn bush was good for nothing apart from burning. And the point, of course, is that a false hope, like having Abimelech as your king, is going to be self-destructive. And that, of course, is exactly what the people of Shechem and their new king deserve. The interpretation of the parable by Jotham in verses 16 to 20 gives everybody a heads up about what's to follow, that God's judgment is about to fall, that people are going to be given over by God to the terrible consequences of their own choices. And that, by the way, is how God's judgment works. Not that God is passive. He doesn't just sit back and let things take their course. But when he does actively judge, he ultimately gives us what we ask for. He gives people over to the very self-destructive choices that people make. So if people prefer to live without God, then God in his wrath will give us what we choose. And that will be our undoing forever. Romans chapter 1, verse 18 says that the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven even now against all the godlessness and wickedness of men. And what Paul means by that is that God allows people to become enslaved to the things they worship. Much of the disorder and the chaos and the misery in society today is because God has said to us, have it your way. in His judgment and in His justice, God is allowing us to have it our way. And it is hideous. In the results, we reap what we sow. For 3 years, everything seemed fine, verse 22. But then God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem. And from that point on, they basically destroy each other. So in verses 39, we didn't read it all, but let me just give you a very brief breakdown. In verses 39 to 41, Abimelech makes an end of his latest rival, a man called Gaal. In verse 44, he turns on the residents of Shechem. He burns out a tower in verse 49, in which all the leaders of Shechem were hiding out. And then he goes to another town called Thebes, besieging and capturing it too, for apparently no reason, apart from maybe he was having a really angry day. And finally, as he is about to burn out yet another tower in which people are hiding, a certain woman with apparently very big biceps manages to drop a huge rock off the top of the tower, and it lands with perfect aim right on Abimelech's head in verse 53. As one commentator puts it, Abimelech discovered too late that a certain woman had a crush on him. Sorry, that's really bad, isn't it? Anyway, too embarrassed to be killed by a woman, he got his servant to speed things up by running his sword through him, and then it was all over. Now, clearly we're being warned in this chapter that God is a God of justice, who has every right to give us over to the self-destructive choices that we make. To bank on a false hope will result in ruin. Now, it is, of course, a good thing that God is just. It's a good thing that evil will ultimately self-destruct. It's a good thing that every tyrannical regime on the face of the earth will ultimately be destroyed by God. It's a good thing that evil will never have the last word. We should praise God that He is a God of justice. The problem is, of course, that we're all guilty. As I was saying earlier, we've all dealt in the currency of false hope. We've all looked to things other than God to give us the security and the fullness of life that we long for. And in a way, we're our own worst enemy. By the end of chapter 9, the deliverance that Israel needs is not this time from the Moabites or the Midianites. No, this time Israel needs saved from Israel. We're our own worst enemy. Way back in mid-1907, you've probably heard this illustration, but way back in mid-1907, the Times newspaper in England invited several eminent authors to write essays on the theme, "What's Wrong with the World?" There were, of course, many responses, but the shortest came from G.K. Chesterton, who simply wrote, "Dear sirs, regarding your article, 'What's Wrong with the World?' I am, yours sincerely, G.K. Chesterton." And if that's true, then where is our hope? Where is our hope? The answer, of course, as the whole book of Judges labors to make the point, I think, is that we need a Messiah. We need a king who can save us, even from ourselves. And therefore, the entire book of Judges is really a longing for Jesus. Abimelech is an antichrist that makes us long for the real one. Contrast Abimelech with Jesus. Jesus had all authority in heaven and on earth, and yet he came not to be served, but to serve. Instead of deceiving people and tricking them, he is the truth. Instead of being hypocritical, he practiced what he preached. I mean, even as he was hanging on the cross, said, "Lord, forgive them. They know not what they do." Instead of hating his own brothers and his own people, he gave up his life in love even for his enemies. He is the complete opposite of Abimelech. And the reason that Jesus did it all, of course, is so that God could be both just, because he is always just. God could be both just and merciful right at the same time. And that's what this table proclaims this morning. That our sin had to be punished. That there was a terrible price to pay for all our rebellion, for all of our false hopes, for all of our idolatry and the way in which we've lived, and yet Jesus has done it all. for us. He has paid the price for us. And that's why he alone is the hope of the world. We need him to be our Savior. And God knows our world needs the transforming power of his saving love. I finish with this story of the Cardi family. I don't know if you've heard of them, but 2 or 3 years ago, Mr. Randy Cardi was interviewed on the news following the conviction of Robert Black for the abduction, rape, and murder of his 9-year-old daughter on the 12th of August, 1981. I was driving along the road, listening to the radio, listening to this man being interviewed, and I nearly had to pull over. It was just so overwhelming. He said that he wished his daughter's killer to know the love and mercy and grace of God that he himself had found in Jesus Christ. I think it was the most powerful testimony to the grace of God that I have ever heard in my entire life. And the question is, do you too know the love and mercy and grace of God in Jesus Christ? That he is not only the hope of the world, which of course he is, but that he is your hope and your life and your peace. To him be the glory.